I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land upon which this recording takes place, the Gubbi Gubbi people of Southeast Queensland. I honour their continuing connection to land, sea and sky, as well as their elders, past, present and emerging. Hey there, welcome back to the Men, Sex and Pleasure podcast. I'm your host, Cam Fraser. This is episode number 209. We're talking all things masculinity, sexuality, male bodies and men's experiences of pleasure. And on today's episode, I have the pleasure of bringing you another solo episode. I've not done a solo episode for about 150 or so odd episodes. The last time I did that, I talked about my opinions regarding pornography. And in this episode, I want to talk to you about my opinions regarding semen retention. Specifically, I want to unpack some of the claims that you may have heard with regards to semen retention. I share a little bit of my opinions in this episode as well with regards to ejaculation frequency and my own personal practice, as well as the practice that I suggest for the clients that I work with. If you have followed me online, you'll know that I'm not dogmatic about this, and I don't like prescriptive advice when it comes to ejaculation frequency. So this may not come as a surprise to you, this debunking or unpacking of these claims. You may hear the voices of some folks in this episode that you follow. I try and use some select clips from people in the male sexual education or like semen retention space to use as spokespeople, or at least to showcase some of the claims that I then go on to unpack and debunk, so that you know that there are people teaching these things. I'm not just pulling them out of thin air. Hopefully it's worthwhile. It's enjoyable for me to do the research to educate myself about the claims being made and become a better practitioner myself. So I hope it is enjoyable listening for you. If you're interested in semen retention, the quote unquote science behind it, or just getting more nuance and perspective and understanding about the claims of semen retention, then hopefully this is the episode for you. I hope you enjoy. There are specific claims that are made in the semen retention communities that I want to unpack. If you follow me online, you might have seen me do this via Instagram and TikTok videos, but I thought it'd be worthwhile compiling everything into one episode and making it accessible and easy for everyone to get all this information. So let's start with the big one, which is testosterone.
Now, the question that I often get, in fact, is one of the questions I get most often in the comments on YouTube, I don't know why that is whether or not ejaculation adjusts testosterone levels. And it turns out there are two studies that I could find that were quality studies on PubMed that address this, that sex and ejaculation itself does not reduce testosterone levels, although it will increase prolactin levels for the reasons I described a moment ago. However, abstinence or sex without ejaculation for a week or more will increase testosterone levels up to 400%. So the answer is actually complicated. It's not straightforward. What it means is that sex itself increases testosterone. However, abstinence also increases testosterone even further. So it's a nuanced answer. And I hope this is satisfactory, no pun intended, to those of you that have been asking me, what is the relationship between sex and ejaculation and testosterone and dopamine? It is nuanced. And you have to understand that nuance if you want to understand how certain behaviors impact hormones and how hormones impact those behaviors.
So you just heard Andrew Huberman talk on his podcast about ejaculation frequency and testosterone. And as he mentions, it is one of the most asked questions that he gets. That is because this is a big one. As I said before, this is one of the biggest claims about semen retention, is that it will boost your testosterone. So the claim that not ejaculating for a week or more, as Huberman states, increases your testosterone levels by up to 400% is actually an exaggeration of a piece of research that came out of China in 2003. So I don't know where Huberman got this 400% figure from, because the study that he is citing, Jiang et al. In 2003, found that there was a 145.7% increase in serum testosterone levels after 7 days of not ejaculating. So what you need to know about that study is that it only had a sample size of 28 men, and it was also self-reported. We know that there is some unreliability when it comes to men self-reporting sexual behavior, such as how many times they masturbated, how many times they ejaculated, how many times they had sex, for example. So that piece of research, should the unreliability of the self-reported data and also the fact that it was only a small sample size, should be raising some red flags for you, but there's more. So the article has actually been retracted from the Journal of Zhejiang University, and that was done in 2022. Because Dr. Nicole Prowse, who's a sex researcher, inquired with the lead author of the study requesting a copy of the original data, which has never been replicated. The data were never provided to Dr. Prowse, so she contacted the editor of the journal for assistance. Inevitably, the study was retracted because it was found to have been previously published elsewhere, which was not disclosed. And that's a no-no in academia. And beyond that, two of the four authors are now no longer contactable. The original data has still not been provided. Now, that's not to say that it's not good data, but as Dr. Prowse states in an article that she wrote, double dipping in publications and missing authors is highly suspect. As I mentioned before, the study is quite small to begin with, and it certainly wasn't conclusive. There was a 2021 conceptual analysis article, which I also think is worthwhile reading here, because it essentially speaks to this whole point. The article, like I said, from 2021, is entitled, "Is Ejaculation Frequency in Men Related to General and Mental Health?" So I'll read this excerpt as follows. "Social media sites that promote masturbatory abstinence regularly claim that there is scientific evidence that abstinence is beneficial for men's testosterone levels. These sites support their statement by referencing a study, Jiang et al. From 2003, the studies we're talking about, in which a peak in serum testosterone levels after 7 days of abstinence was reported in male participants. Notably, the results reported on the basis of a small sample size. To the best of our knowledge, these results were not replicated so far. In this line of research, another study investigated the effect of 3 weeks abstinence on different endocrine responses, including testosterone. Here, the authors reported that abstinence led to an increase in basal testosterone level, yet did not alter the typical cardiovascular and endocrine responses to orgasm. Therefore, they concluded that abstinence has an insufficient impact on endocrine responses." That's a 2001 article from Exton et al. To note, this study also had a small sample size. Here's the kicker. Far-reaching statements about beneficial effects of abstinence on males' testosterone levels need to be taken with caution. Indeed, the role of testosterone in sexual activity appears to be more nuanced. And to his credit, Huberman does go on to say in that podcast that it is much more nuanced. However, that nuance seems to be dismissed when claims about semen retention boosting or improving your testosterone are made, and they are made plentifully, unfortunately. So those are the only two studies that have been done on ejaculation frequency and testosterone and the correlation between those two. One of them has been retracted. It has never been replicated, and it was a tiny sample size. The other one, also small sample size, and the authors themselves concluded that the abstinence period has an insufficient impact on endocrine responses. That's as far as we can go. Any further claims about testosterone are either anecdotal or just completely made up. My personal opinion, as I said I would share, is that, and I'll speak for myself, I have personally felt some increase in, let's call it, energy levels. And by energy levels, I mean I felt a bit more alive and lively and sprightly and energized and more, let's say, sexual tension and quicker sexual arousal, quicker sexual desire by not masturbating, having sex, watching porn, or ejaculating for a period of time longer than 7 days. I have noticed that I have a certain response to not doing those things. Does that correlate to an increase in testosterone? Possibly not, and probably not, according to some of this data. However, there's an impact that I notice on my own, like I said, energy levels. And some people might like to label that as virility or vitality or sexual energy. Again, different strokes of different folks, I suppose. And I've also noticed experiences that my clients have had, which is when they take ejaculation off the table for an experimental extended period of time, say between 7 days to 21 days, that they also notice changes in their mood, similar to myself, their levels of energy and aliveness, their desire for sex, but also things like frustration and tension in their body, as well as other aspects of their life. It has an impact when you don't do those things as opposed to when you do those things. So what I also have personally experimented with, and what I will also invite my clients to experiment with if they feel comfortable doing so, is doing the opposite. So rather than not ejaculating for 7 days, I'll invite them to ejaculate every day for 7 days and notice how that feels for them. The experience that I have had when I ejaculate every day for 7 days, and I've done that either by having sex every day for 7 days and ejaculating that way, or watching porn and masturbating and ejaculating, or not watching porn and masturbating and ejaculating. I've experimented personally through a bunch of different approaches. And again, I notice changes, as you are probably going to if you do that, right? And that's kind of the point, is like, let's pay attention to what you personally experience if you ejaculate every single day for 14 days compared to not ejaculating for 14 days. Pay attention to that and notice what comes up for you, right? Rather than being prescriptive and rather than being dogmatic, I think there's opportunity to explore and experiment with your own sexual response and noticing what you experience. That's what I encourage. And I'm going to weave a little bit more of my opinions through these claims. But I've personally noticed a difference in not ejaculating for a certain period of time. And I've also noticed a difference ejaculating frequently for a period of time. And I think it's important to explore that for your own sake, so that you've got that data, let's call it, about yourself. All right, let's move on to another claim here. This is about semen retention curing depression.
I'm telling you, man, semen retention cures depression. So if you're depressed right now, you hate your job, you hate your life, you hate the girls. Hold on. You hate the girls you hate the girls you attract. And when I say that, I'm saying the girls you like on Instagram don't match up to the girls you like in real life. That's a lot of men frustration. So I know you tired of that life. Semen retention cures depression, man. Go a few weeks, go a month without having sex. Go 7 days without watching porn and having sex. Watch how you start feeling alive. Watch how you stop worrying.
So the extended claim here, I found a meme of, and this meme reads, generally, men suffer from depression more than women. Various science institutions have come to the conclusion that semen possesses antidepressant properties. Experiments were done with women suffering from depression. Those who had sex with condoms stayed depressed or got worse. Those who had sex without protection got cured. The same results were found in oral sex. This discovery therefore means that depressed men can cure their depression simply by stopping ejaculating of their semen, which explains why men who do semen retention for very long periods show tremendous signs of joy and happiness, because semen is an antidepressant. All right, let's break this down. So while women do report more mild depression, whereas men report more severe depression, and depressed men are more likely to report things like loss of appetite, weight loss, insomnia, anger, irritability, and are more likely to engage in alcohol and substance abuse than depressed women, it is women who have a higher prevalence rate of depression compared to men. So that first claim about men suffering from depression more than women, depending on how generously you want to interpret it, whether it's about prevalence rate or the way that depression affects men compared to the way it affects women, I don't know, it's up for debate. But the main claim about the antidepressant effects of semen seems to come from a journal article from 2002, Gallup et al. Now, what that study actually found was that women who did not use condoms during sex had lower levels of depressive symptoms compared to women who usually or always use them, and to women who abstained from sex altogether. The authors suggest that this resulted from vaginal absorption of semen, citing a single case study from 1986, which argued that prostaglandins found in semen can be absorbed into a woman's bloodstream and have an antidepressant effect. That 1986 paper in turn cites a 1977 review of prostaglandins to make that claim. However, this review found one study which reported slight increases in prostaglandin synthesis in depressed patients, and another later study also found that prostaglandin concentrations were significantly higher in depressed patients. So if the absorption of prostaglandins in semen had an antidepressant effect, you'd expect depressed patients to have a lower level of prostaglandins. Yet this doesn't appear to be true. Hence, the idea that semen has antidepressant properties doesn't appear to be based on the available evidence. As for oral sex, I could only find one source about swallowing sperm, and that found that it may be correlated with a diminished occurrence of preeclampsia, but not depression. Again, based on what I could find, there's no evidence for the claim that semen is an antidepressant. Claims like this are a result of media outlets misreporting scientific papers. You can blame The Sun and the Daily Mail, for example, publishing headlines such as semen cures depression, or like oral sex is good for women's health and things like that. And semen retention practitioners typically don't do their due diligence. They won't go in and dig into the study. So I want to go back to this 2002 study from Gallup et al., which again, kind of appears to be the central source for this claim, and look at the research methods, because it states in the methods that they use condom usage as an indirect measure of semen being present in the vaginal canal, right? So whether or not a woman in the study reported that she used a condom or not, that was determined to then indicate whether there was going to be semen in her vagina, which was then absorbed and had antidepressant effects. So that was like the indirect measure. That was the method that they were using. However, given that 13% of women in one study, that was a 2014 study, reported that withdrawal was their most effective method of contraception, so taking the penis out of the vagina before it ejaculates and maybe ejaculating somewhere else, it follows that condom usage isn't really a reliable measure of the presence of semen in the vagina. The authors of that study also didn't properly consider a range of alternatives and alternative explanations. So, for example, instead of condom usage causing depression, depression itself may lead to condom usage. So there was a 1996 study that examined safe sex practices over a three-month period and found that women who were depressed when the study began or who became depressed later on were more likely to use condoms. But even in a study like this, it's still difficult to untangle causality, as it isn't clear why the women were initially depressed or if the sexual activity that they were having impacted their depression. All this is to say that the claim that semen retention has antidepressant effects not only lacks any direct evidence, there doesn't really appear to be any plausible biological reason to believe that the components of semen have a beneficial effect on mood. Unfortunately, I don't think this will stop semen retention practitioners from promoting and perpetuating and peddling this information. I don't really know what my personal opinion on this is. I just don't think it's true. I don't think that there's antidepressant effects. Like, it's not to say that there aren't molecules and chemicals and minerals and other things in semen that, and calories as well, right? Proteins, things like that, that can be ingested or that can be absorbed vaginally. We know about what's called microchimerism, which is the presence of male DNA in women's bloodstreams. And there might be, and I say a very heavy might be, the reason for that being that there is a transmission of that male DNA from semen into that woman's bloodstream via vaginal absorption. However, microchimerism has also been found in prepubescent girls. That was a study that was done in the Netherlands, I believe, or maybe Denmark, actually. And to the author's knowledge of that study, they were girls who hadn't, I don't want to say had sex, because at that age, it isn't having sex, it's being sexually abused. And there's a theory that it might be due to an older brother. So again, that's contested and not exactly concrete. And so I'm open to the idea that there might be an effect of absorption or ingestion of semen. How pronounced that is, who's to say? I think there's much more research needed. That's going to be a common theme in all these claims. So yeah, not really sure what I want to say around this. I know people have their more, let's say, esoteric beliefs around not only seminal fluid, but like menstrual fluid as well. And I, again, don't want to dismiss or diminish people's practices. Like I have friends and colleagues who I know have imbibing practices of, or topical application practices of, let's call them sacred fluids, ejaculate and menstrual fluids. And there's the belief and experience that they have that it's impactful for them spiritually or religiously. And I think that's beautiful, and you can have that practice, and I don't have any issues or concerns with that. I think when you make claims specifically about antidepressant effects, you need much more than just a 2002 study, which is citing some pretty dodgy or scant, let's say, research about prostaglandins. Anyway, we'll move on to another claim. Let's talk about zinc, because I mentioned that the ejaculate, right, seminal fluid, contains proteins, minerals, amino acids, a bunch of stuff, right? It's pretty well understood. But then some interesting claims get made by semen retention practitioners about those. So one claim you often hear is about zinc.
And you know, in one like average load, you can lose up to 50 milligrams of zinc. And that's about the daily recommendation for males about my size, like 80 kilo. And you know, if you're eating about 50 milligrams of zinc every day, it doesn't mean that your body absorbs all that 15 milligrams. So, and if you're fapping every day, you are supposedly losing 15 milligrams of zinc every day, plus the magnesium, calcium, potassium. So think about this. You're actually like fapping away important nutrients.
So if that was a bit difficult to understand because of his accent, he's saying that there's 15 milligrams of zinc in a ejaculation. So let's unpack this. So the World Health Organization, the European Food Safety Authority, and the Institute of Medicine recommend that the daily intake of zinc for men to be approximately 11 to 14 milligrams. So this guy is correct in saying that the amount of zinc he needs per day is about 15 milligrams. You probably know where this is going. He is incorrect to say that he loses, or that we lose as men, 15 milligrams every time we ejaculate. That is very incorrect. And so I want to break this down. So between the years of 1986 and 2010, there have been 9 different studies looking at the concentrations of zinc in those study participants' seminal fluid, ranging from the lowest micrograms per milliliter, which was in 1986 by Tikiwal et al., at 78.9 micrograms per milliliter. And then the most concentrated was from Chia et al. In 2000, which had 183.6 micrograms per milliliter in their study participants' seminal fluid. So let's take that most concentrated measurement from this list of 9 different studies and do some quick math here. So if Chia et al. In the year 2000, in their study, found a seminal zinc concentration of 183.6 micrograms per milliliter. Then we convert the measurement to milligrams per milliliter by dividing by 1,000, which gives us 0.1836 milligrams per milliliter. And according to the International Society for Sexual Medicine, on average, men expel between 1.25 and 5 milliliters of semen each time they ejaculate. So if we times by 5 and be generous and use 5 mil as the quantity there. According to this math, a 5 mil ejaculation would have 0.918 milligrams of zinc, not 15 milligrams. We can do this a different way. So according to Ozadchuk et al. In 2021, the seminal concentration of zinc is 1,571.8 micromoles per liter. So we can convert this to moles per liter, which equals 0.0015718 moles per liter. And given that the molecular weight of zinc is 65.38, we end up converting and getting to 0.102764 milligrams per milliliter. Again, we'll be generous and presume an ejaculation of 5 mils, so we times by 5, and we get 0.51482 milligrams per ejaculation. Again, not 15 milligrams. Just for putting the last nail in the coffin here, we'll do another way of approaching this. So there was researchers, Owen and Katz, in 2013 who were formulating a semen simulant. So they were trying to recreate semen in a lab. And they determined a target zinc concentration of 16.5 milligrams per 100 milliliters. So if we reduce that down by dividing by 20 into one ejaculation, we get 0.825 milligrams per 5 mil ejaculation. So, 3 different ways of looking at this. Assuming a man ejaculates 5 milliliters, he will lose less than 1 milligram per ejaculation, a far cry from 15 milligrams that the claim is that he loses. And that's not to mention, I find this like interesting, that the glass containers that are used to store the semen in can sometimes contain enough zinc to influence zinc concentration measurements in the first place. So human error within those as well. We can revisit the recommendations from the Institute of Medicine and the European Food Safety Authority, as well as the International Zinc Nutrition Consultative Group. And we can see from their documentation that they actually include seminal zinc losses, which uses data from two studies, Johnson et al. In 1993 and Hunt et al. In 1992. So in their reference tables, they suggest that 0.1 milligram of zinc is lost per day based on an average ejaculate volume of 2.8 milliliters and a weekly average of 2.45 ejaculations. So you can take those recommendations at face value, I suppose, because some people probably ejaculate much more than that. Some people possibly much less, depending on whether they're a practitioner of semen retention or not. But again, it's a far cry from 15 milligrams per ejaculation. We can continue this thread of nutrition and what's being lost from an ejaculation, or at least the claims that are being made, with the following claim.
What is interesting as I've gone down this rabbit hole is I found this guy named Dr. Stephen Chang. Dr. Stephen Chang is like an OG Taoist master. Now, if he had been born today, he would have been like the Montauk Chia, right? He was just like epic. But because he was a little older, most people don't know about him. But he was also a medical doctor. So he was got the sort of the Eastern and the Western kind of combined. And when I went into his work, I found this research that he did where basically he talked about every time we ejaculate, you know, in our semen, we have proteins, we have minerals, we have vitamins, and we have amino acids. And the equivalent, it's actually kind of shocking, but the equivalent of 2 pieces of New York steak, 10 eggs, 6 oranges, and 2 lemons. So every time we bust, that's what is draining out of our system.
So that voice might sound familiar. That's Tyson Adams. He's a friend of mine, a colleague, semen retention practitioner, and he's been on my podcast twice. I have spoken to Tyson behind the scenes about this particular claim, and I don't mind sharing that he has been receptive to the challenge of that claim, and generally he's been quite receptive to some of the challenges that I've offered to the claims of the semen retention community in general. So no animosity at all to Tyson. Like I said, he's been on the podcast twice. We've had some amazing conversations, and he's very receptive to the pushback, and I'm also receptive to his pushback. So no love lost at all. So what Tyson is referencing here is Dr. Stephen T. Chang, which interestingly enough is only 9 years older than Mantek Chia. So, and they're both still alive. From what I understand, I couldn't find any information about Stephen T. Chang's death. So yeah, was curious there about the way that Tyson framed that statement about Stephen T. Chang. However, his 1986 book, The Tao of Sexology, is where this particular claim comes from, where Dr. Chang writes about the nutritional value of 1 tablespoon of semen. He writes, "When the average male ejaculates, he loses about 1 tablespoon of semen. According to scientific research, the nutritional value of this amount of semen is equal to that of 2 pieces of New York steak, 10 eggs, 6 oranges, and 2 lemons. This includes proteins, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, everything." End quote. Now, I mentioned this just before, but according to the Society of Sexual Medicine, the International Society of Sexual Medicine, on average, men expel between 1.25 and 5 milliliters of semen each time they ejaculate, which is about 1 teaspoon, not a tablespoon, like Dr. Chang states. That would be 15 milliliters. as opposed to 5 milliliters. So that's the first red flag. Secondly, Dr. Chang writes that the nutritional value of semen he has listed is quote unquote, according to scientific research, but does not cite any sources. I've read the book and there's no sources available for this claim that it's according to scientific research. So I'm going out on a limb here and just interpreting this claim at face value. I'll do this, and then I want to speak about what a different interpretation could be and why that's a little bit more difficult to actually fact check. So face value interpretation. Let's reference a few studies here. The average total protein concentration of semen is 5,040 milligrams per 100 milliliters. That's again, thanks to Owen and Katz in 2013 with their semen simulant. They were making ejaculate in a lab. So this means that a single 5 milliliter ejaculation would have about 252 milligrams of protein. Again, if we divide that by 20. So we don't need to do too much math here because according to the US Department of Agriculture, one large egg contains 6.3 grams of protein, much, much more than 252 milligrams. So needless to say that 10 eggs plus two steaks has much more protein than a single ejaculation. In fact, I did a little bit of math here for funsies, and it's almost 640 times more, considering that the US Department of Agriculture states that a steak has 49.4 grams of protein. Again, one ejaculation has about 252 milligrams of protein. So what about vitamin C? This is also known as ascorbic acid. So in one study, the median level of ascorbic acid in patients with normal semen parameters was 7.7 milligrams per deciliter. That's Song, Norcus, and Lewis in 2006. An earlier study found seminal ascorbic acid levels in healthy sperm donors was 10.7 milligrams per deciliter. That's Thiel et al. In 1995. So using the larger quantity, 10.7 milligrams per deciliter, this means that 1 5 milliliter ejaculation would contain approximately 0.535 milligrams of vitamin C. Again, we'll go back to the US Department of Agriculture here. We don't need to do a lot of math either because according to them, one orange contains 82.7 milligrams of vitamin C, much, much more than 0.535 milligrams of vitamin C. You're probably noticing a pattern here. And we looked at zinc just before. Needless to say that one ejaculate does not contain the same amount as two steaks, 10 eggs, etc., etc. However, I want to concede here that there is a different way of interpreting it, which I think is probably the more correct way of interpreting this particular claim. Again, no references were made, no sources were cited. So I'm, again, maybe making a good faith interpretation here. But two things lead me to this. The first is that Dr. Chang he's a Chinese man, a Taoist practitioner. English is not his first language. From what I understand, think this book was written in Chinese and then translated. And so the translation here might be adding to some of the confusion with regards to how this is interpreted. And also this interpretation, at least in my mind, makes more sense, which is that you have to eat this amount of food in order to then produce one ejaculate. That would make more sense in the context of Taoist practices, traditional Chinese medicine, and even Ayurveda, where the understanding and belief is that you consume food and through like this downstepping process, the food then becomes like the blood then becomes like cerebral fluid, that cerebral fluid then becomes ejaculate. And so again, the more generous interpretation of this, rather than one tablespoon of semen, as Dr. Chang states, being equivalent to all of these things, all of this nutrition, it's that you have to eat all of that in order to then get to one ejaculate. to produce one ejaculate. That's beyond my capabilities of figuring out. I tried to look up research around dietary impacts on semen parameters, and yes, which like, duh, of course, there are impacts that your diet has on your sperm, on your seminal fluid, on the parameters of your semen. So like sperm motility and mobility, we know that trans fats or polyunsaturated trans fats are going to have different impacts. The Mediterranean diet, which is high in fish compared to a diet that's high in red meat, for example, are going to have different impacts on sperm health and seminal quality. I don't know how to figure out, like I said, it's beyond my capabilities, how to fact check that claim in the way that it's stated there. So I'm going to, again, in good faith, say, yes, you're going to have a good diet in order to produce seminal fluid, prostatic fluid, sperm, the three things that make up your ejaculate, because that's just how things work for all bodily fluids. So yeah, don't know how to fact check that in a specific way that's able to like bust it as a claim. But I thought the way that I've seen it interpreted is that semen itself is equal to that nutrition, and that's not correct. And look, I don't want to poison the well too much here, but I did a little bit of digging just into Stephen T. Chang as a practitioner. And one of the things that caught my attention was that in the biographies that I could find of him online, and I don't know if they were autobiographies or biographies, and they weren't very long. One came from what I believe was his own website. It states, and I'll be fully transparent here, that this required heavy use of Google Translate on my behalf, because I do not speak Chinese and I cannot read Chinese characters. So happy to be corrected if someone knows this, or if Stephen T. Chang, who I've tried to get in touch with through various channels available, can correct me, is that Stephen T. Chang is the quote unquote westernized version of his name that he chose to adapt from his original Chinese name, which, and I apologize, I will butcher this, is Zhang Shutong. And so one of the accolades that's listed as part of Zhang Shutong's biographies across the internet is that he was connected to the Reagan presidency, that he had actually received an award from the Reagan presidency. I thought that'd be pretty easy to fact check, because meticulous records are typically kept regarding US presidents. For example, the records of the Reagan presidency are preserved via the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. So I actually contacted the archivists of the museum and I asked if they had any records of a Zhang Shutong or a Stephen T. Chang, and they were unable to find anything. Mr. Kelly D. Barton, who's an archivist at the Ronald Reagan Library, he emailed me back and he said, quote, "I've done our usual name searches for Dr. Zhang or Dr. Chang using our current finding aids, and I'm unable to find anything in our holdings." Now, I don't mean to cast aspersions on Dr. Chang, who has written a plethora of books and is obviously respected in Taoist communities. But I want to highlight how the way these kind of semen retention communities and practitioners will take these authoritative claims about sexual and reproductive health at face value, because there's a confirmation bias that's happening there in these semen retention philosophies and practices. I don't think there's anything wrong with questioning or challenging the claims made by Taoist masters such as Stephen T. Chang, such as Mantak Chia, for example, especially when a lot of these claims made in these books from like the 1970s and 80s were made during a time when we didn't know as much about seminal fluid as we do today. Like, a lot of the research that I'm citing is from the 90s onwards, and this wouldn't have been available to these practitioners when they were writing these books and making these claims. So yeah, that's my two cents about that, I suppose. And hopefully that made sense as well. I don't mean to like try and cast aspersions or I'm not trying to be an asshole about this. I want to make sure that the information's out there and that people are okay with their practice, because I don't think there's anything wrong with the practice. I just think these claims need to be addressed. All right, let's jump into another one.
Yeah, so there's actually a really good study that was done looking at ejaculation frequency and prostate cancer. And it was a very well done study. They tried to control for a lot of other factors. And so what they found was that men who ejaculated 21 times or more a month were less likely to develop prostate cancer. This is just a statistical number. It is not a number that sort of means anything in terms of, but we're seeing that, like, okay, so more masturbation may help. Why is that, right? So there's a prostate stagnation hypothesis that the fluids that, you know, some of your ejaculate fluids come from the prostate. And so when you're ejaculating frequently, you're more often getting rid of that fluid and sort of replenishing it, or cleaning the pipes, so to say.
So this is a claim that people ask me about all the time when I talk about semen retention. It's usually brought up as a bit of like a rebuttal to semen retention, as like a bit of a gotcha. And typically it's people referencing a headline that they've seen. If people know the research, then happy to give them the accolades that they deserve for citing actual research. But very often in my experience speaking with people online, they're referencing like a Daily Mail headline or The Sun or whatever, some sort of magazine or newspaper. Again, because there's a common trend of them misrepresenting or misreporting scientific studies. However, the study that's being cited here is from 2016, Ryder et al. And it found that more frequent ejaculation, 21 times or more per month, is associated with a decreased risk of prostate cancer. That study made headlines at the time because it was a study that had a large sample size, about 32,000 men, and it was conducted over a relatively long period of time from 1992 to 2010. I mentioned this before, but I have my reservations about the accuracy of studies like this due to the possible unreliability of self-reported sexual behavior, particularly by men, as over and under exaggerations that happen when men report sexual behavior, particularly when it comes to masturbation and ejaculation and watching porn. But anyway, interestingly, an earlier study of that same cohort of men found ejaculation frequency is not statistically significantly associated with prostate cancer. That was an earlier study from, I think it was 2006. In a separate 2008 study with a different sample of men, so this is unrelated, it was found that frequent ejaculation in younger life increases risk of prostate cancer, but frequent ejaculation in older life is protective against prostate cancer. There have also been several systematic reviews regarding the connection between ejaculation frequency and prostate cancer, and all of them report inconclusive findings. For example, one review found there to be no universally accepted themes and insufficient agreement about the relationship between ejaculation frequency and prostate cancer. Another review found no linear association between ejaculation frequency and the risk of prostate cancer. And as one review noted, least convincing evidence is available for the interaction of sexual activity and prostate cancer, and well-conducted and longitudinal studies are clearly necessary to evaluate whether the suggested associations between prostate cancer risk and sexual behavior are real or spurious. So depending on which study you want to reference and which systematic review you want to believe, you can say a number of different things about semen retention or ejaculation frequency and prostate cancer. My opinion, which is based on the most recent review conducted in 2019, is that we simply cannot tell if there is a causal relationship. It's correlational, right? There's something going on there with regards to how many times you're coming and your general health and prostate specifically. That's all we can say. We don't know what the effect is. In any case, while that 2016 study, the big one with 32,000 men, while it did try to control for other factors, I think this whole debate about ejaculation frequency and prostate cancer is missing the forest for the trees, because there are better ways of caring for your prostate than just changing how many times you ejaculate. So I usually tell my clients, instead of worrying about ejaculation frequency, if they are really concerned about their prostate health, They should focus on things like not smoking or drinking alcohol, eating a good diet, making sure they're taking the right supplements, and doing regular prostate massages. I think that's much more beneficial for your prostate than changing the amount or the frequency of your ejaculation. So that's an interesting one to just throw in there. I'm a big advocate for prostate stimulation, prostate orgasms, prostate health in general. And because I also encourage guys to experiment with not ejaculating so much, this is something that's often brought up in conversations. And so, yeah, I navigate that by saying, hey, everything that I just shared with you, and that there's other ways that you can take care of your prostate if that is of concern for you. And I think it's a valid concern considering how common prostate cancer is, for example. And so making sure that like you're doing regular prostate massages, which sometimes called prostate milking, which help the prostate secrete prostatic fluid so that it's not getting stagnant or it's not getting trapped in the prostatic ducts, is going to be beneficial for you, right? That's kind of the supposed theoretical underlying mechanism of why they think ejaculation is linked to decreased risk of prostate cancer, because you're flushing the pipes out, is kind of the layman's way of thinking about it. That ejaculatory reflex is something that helps squeeze the stagnant fluid from the prostate and seminal vesicles out, so that it gets flushed out and doesn't become stagnant and stationary. You can do that, sure, by ejaculating, and you can also do that with prostate massage. And there's some evidence to suggest that at-home prostate massage has been linked to decreasing incidence of prostatitis. There's various types of prostatitis, but for the sake of that particular research, it was like inflamed prostate inflammation. And there is some evidence, again, very minimal, that links prostatitis and prostate inflammation to prostate cancer. So if you follow the loosely connected logic there, and I admit that it is loose, then prostate massages can be helpful for potentially reducing the risk of prostate cancer. And again, I believe it's the underlying mechanism there of cleaning out the ducts, so to speak. So, again, more research necessary. As with all these claims, I would love to see more research into all of this stuff, but sex research is notoriously difficult to do, partly because of funding, partly because of ethics, partly because of sample sizes and things like that. So yeah, always calling for more research. Let's jump into two more little claims here. So the first is an interesting one that I want to just have a chat about.
Every time you ejaculate, your brain releases a ton of chemicals and hormones telling you chill out and relax. And that makes sense because you've done your most important job. Our job as a biological creature is to perpetuate the species, and your body doesn't know whether you've ejaculated with a woman to have a baby or you've ejaculated into your sock. The problem is that when you're ejaculating a lot, you are constantly telling your body chill out and relax, and therefore your motivation decreases. Now here's the evolutionary hack of semen retention. Because you don't ejaculate for numbers of days or for long periods of time, not only are you avoiding any rest or relaxation time, but your body begins to optimize itself, increasing its charge, increasing its aura, increasing your desire, increasing your motivation, increasing your testosterone levels, so that it's more likely that you're going to go out into the world and actually find a partner to procreate with.
So I don't really buy this whole the body can't tell the difference claim. For example, one dated study compared the semen ejaculated by the same men from masturbation and from sex, and found that the volume of seminal plasma, sperm count, sperm motility, and percentage of morphologically healthy sperm were all greater in the sex samples than in the masturbation samples. So that's Sofokidis and Miyagawa from 1993. Similarly, other dated research, this is Purvis et al., 1986, used a within subjects design and found that compared with masturbatory samples of ejaculate, men's sex samples had a larger semen volume and increased concentrations and total amounts of prostaglandin E and polyamines. In yet another dated study, Zavos and Goodpasture, 1989, it was found that sex yielded better sperm volume and morphology than did masturbation. And a more recent study, Brody et al., 2006, found that the magnitude of prolactin increase following sex is 400% greater than that following masturbation. So, according to this research, it seems that there's some evidence that the body might be able to tell the difference between masturbating and ejaculating and having sex and ejaculating. I also think it's funny that a lot of these semen retention practitioners will say that the body is like a conduit for the divine, or that the body is spiritually and esoterically significant with its wisdom, and really treat the body as this vehicle for energy and philosophical or esoteric kind of knowledge. And then they'll also say that the body is also so dumb that it can't tell that it's ejaculated into a sock. It seems a little inconsistent. And I always think that that's, I just find that quite interesting with regards to the semen retention community, that trying to have their cake and eat it too with regards to quoting scientific literature, trying to mold it to fit their semen retention claims, to the point where they'll go against some of the things that they're saying about the body. So yeah. I think it's fascinating that the body does show a difference in its ejaculate quality. And this has been studied in other ways as well. We know that there is such a thing as sperm allocation and sperm depletion in human males. Men allocate certain amounts of sperm, different types of sperm, depending on the sexual context. For example, there's some interesting research around group sex and like the underlying mechanism is sexual competition, which found that like when men are under the impression that either their partner is going to have extra pair copulations, so you know, going to be sleeping with other men, that they will produce more sperm, more seminal volume, and I think that's more seminal motility as well, so sperm motility, sorry, if I remember the data correctly. And they did some work with like watching group sex on screen as well. It's like there's some interesting research there that it seems that men produce more sperm, more volume of semen when they have to quote unquote compete with other men who are ejaculating and contributing sperm. That's fascinating to me. And I think that's interesting to know. There's other research around sperm depletion over time. One of the claims loosely related to this is that like men will be able to have kids or have viable sperm up into their 90s. That isn't entirely true. There is such a thing as sperm depletion. The quality of sperm and the seminal parameters decreases over time, and the amount of sperm also depletes. There isn't a continuous replenishing of sperm until a man dies. There is a depletion there that takes place. It isn't as obviously drastic as the female gamete and eggs and the diminishing of that over time. Still fascinating. And I think that like, I just find it interesting the way that semen retention practitioners try and contort that to their philosophical views around semen retention. Anyway, let's jump into the last one. This is about aging.
Let's look at the plant world. What happens when plants go to seed? You know, the plant puts all of its resources into creating the seed because it needs to continue the species. That's what the function of ejaculation is. It's to continue the species. So of course, nature puts a great priority on this. The body places a great priority on creating this seed so that the species can continue. But what happens to plants that go to seed? They age quickly. They lose their juiciness. They lose their life force. If you're into gardening, you'll notice when you keep a plant from going to seed, it lives longer than the one that goes to seed. So I believe this is how we are as humans.
You might recognize that voice. That's Jonathan White. And to sum up, I read this quote from one of his emails that he sent out, which reads, "Most men are stuck in one extreme end of the spectrum in how they express sexual energy. The first extreme is to recklessly ejaculate on a daily basis, depleting the endocrine system, experiencing serious hormonal imbalances, premature aging, and burnout." So premature aging here is a catch-all term for things like wrinkles, age spots, dryness, loss of skin tone, hyperpigmentation around your chest, and skin sagging. To the best of my knowledge, there are no studies which have looked at the correlation between ejaculation frequency and any of these symptoms. So that claim around premature aging is not backed up by any available scientific evidence. It is very much related to the belief about jinn, life force, energy, essence, and it being expelled and depleted every time you ejaculate. Vitality and virility and power and masculine essence being lost every time you ejaculate. So it's a very common claim in traditional Chinese medicine and Taoist practices, and even in Ayurvedic medicine with regards to ojas. I'd be curious to see research, but it's not like backed. It's not to say that there isn't any evidence for it. There may be, we just haven't found it yet because no one maybe has done the research. So I'd love to see the research. However, again, if you're looking, like this podcast episode is, at the scientific claims themselves, there are no scientific papers looking at premature aging and ejaculation frequency or semen retention. So do with that as you will. That's pretty much the major claims that I could find. There's a lot out there, but these are like the big ones, and hopefully I've done it justice with regards to, you know, unpacking the scientific literature and what it says. As I mentioned earlier on, I'm not against experimenting with not ejaculating. I'm not against experimenting with taking ejaculation off the table. I think it can be a really useful practice for the clients that I work with, at least anyway, and disentangling sex and masturbation, having to end with ejaculation, having to have a goal or an end point attached to that sexual experience. It can bring up some really interesting, conversations between partners, which I like to call the unspoken symbolism of ejaculation. If ejaculation isn't present in a heterosexual context and it's done really mindfully and intentionally, it can bring up some stories to unpack of, well, if he didn't ejaculate, did that mean he didn't enjoy himself? He didn't even enjoy himself. Does that mean he's not attracted to me? Those sort of stories can be brought up. If you've ever had sex with either you were drinking too much or your partner was drinking too much and they couldn't ejaculate, maybe they had whiskey dick, brewer's droop, alcohol-induced impotence, and the sex just couldn't finish with an ejaculation because of the alcohol and the intoxication. Possibly those stories were brought up unintentionally and unconsciously, not very mindfully. Again, there is significance or symbolism attached to what ejaculation is and what it means for people. Very often it's a signifier or a symbol of a man's enjoyment, a man's pleasure. And so if it isn't there, assumptions are made that he didn't enjoy himself or he didn't have a good time. And that can lead to some self-worth stories that can be unpacked. So that's one benefit, at least in my opinion, of exploring semen retention in that regard, taking ejaculation off the table. I'm also not a fan of the term semen retention. I speak about this elsewhere. I'm happy to speak about it more. But I use the term conscious ejaculation, partly because I dislike the way that semen retention is framed. It's framed as about not doing something, right? Retaining your semen, it's about not ejaculating. And that's very much how it's talked about in these communities. When that is the frame of reference, you're you're thinking of suppressing something, suppressing your ejaculation, like not ejaculating, you're thinking about not ejaculating. So that thought suppression practice there is what's known as ironic process theory, or sometimes it's called the white bear problem, because there was a researcher that did a little experiment with some students. He was a professor, I believe in the 1980s, Wegner is his name. And he asked his students to essentially not think about a white bear. And what did all the students do? They thought about a white bear in order to then not think about it, right? The act of trying not to think about something brings that thing firstly to your mind so that then you can suppress it. And there's been, you know, some interesting research, again, not a lot, because that's just the nature of this field, is that there is not a lot of research. But there was some interesting research that found that teenage boys in Israel who were religious, so they were Jewish, were much more prone to meeting the criteria for compulsive sexual behavior than their secular counterparts. Partly because the religious teenage boys were much more preoccupied with trying to suppress their thoughts of sexual activity and sexuality. And so that was causing them a lot of distress. And that distress, according to the way that compulsive sexual behavior is diagnosed, is part of the diagnostic criterion. So the young people who weren't trying to suppress their thoughts about sexual behavior, masturbating, having sex, watching porn, things like that, weren't too fussed. But when you had this ironic process theory happening, or what's called the rebound effect happening, where these religious young people, these religious teenage boys, were really trying not to think about masturbating, not to think about watching porn, they were really trying to suppress those thoughts, the rebound effect was that they were much more preoccupied with those things. And so that caused them some distress. So I feel like that's happening with a lot of these guys in these communities. Like, there is a preoccupation, I almost said obsession, but maybe it's an obsession, a preoccupation with ejaculation and not ejaculating. You know, trying not to ejaculate. And I don't think that's a good way of framing it, right? It's a convoluted way of trying to have a better relationship with your ejaculation. And so I think personally, a better way to do that is by talking about conscious ejaculation, choosing to ejaculate. When you do choose to ejaculate, what do you notice, right? Having a much more positive rather than negative framing around ejaculation, rather than semen retention and what not to do. I focus on conscious ejaculation and what you can do and how you can explore ejaculation, or how you can explore not ejaculating, and what that means for you and how it feels. So there's a bit of a reframe there, at least from my personal experience of, you know, my relationship with ejaculation and the clients that I work with. Anyway, I feel like I've rambled enough for today. I've been slowly sipping on a beer as well, so hopefully everything was coherent. But that's it. There's some interesting information there for you. Hopefully this was of value, and now everything is in one place. So if anyone has any questions about semen retention and the science of it, I'll send in this episode. Thank you for listening.